of depression. Now, the COVID-19 pandemic has ignited the crisis further, as many are facing financial and social hardships. According to psychological experts, economic and social pressures combined with a lack of appropriate mental health facilities is a major reason behind this new epidemic, which has now started exploding due to the coronavirus pandemic. Based on reports, the economic cost of mental illness in India is expected to be more than $1 trillion by 2030.
COVID-19 has impacted a lot. A lot means, you can say, everyone, almost everyone, because one or the other way, everyone has been affected. Whether it's, the infection has caused or the mental health, or the other ways, because the businesses has shut down.
Health experts say all disorders are linked to a fast-paced lifestyle, stress, complexities of living, breakdown of support systems, and challenges of economic instability. They say the COVID pandemic has added fuel to the fire, with depression, anxiety disorders, schizophrenia, psychotic disorders, and substance abuse being common in most people.
One must go for yoga daily. Yoga, you have to do proper yoga. Then breathing exercises are there. They have to do at least half an hour to 1 hour so that the blood circulation towards brain increases.
COVID-19 lockdowns impacted people from all walks of life and age groups. Now they're finding it hard to deal with consequences of the pandemic-induced lockdowns. Many turn to drugs and alcohol, while others prefer religious therapies and yoga. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Britain's travel industry is frustrated and nervous. Protesting around the country on June 23rd, people whose jobs rely on international travel, now only working at 10% capacity. They want more countries on the so-called green list to save jobs.
It just doesn't make a lot of sense. And then why put some on the green list and then take them off? Like, say we booked a holiday to Portugal. We were supposed to be there this week and we've cancelled it because it went amber and it was going to cost another £1,000 in COVID tests.
The restrictions are now crazy. So I'm stuck in England for quite a long time. And I wish to travel back to my country as I haven't seen my mum for 2 years.
Green means arrivals to the UK do not need to self-isolate, but have to take a test before and after they travel. Amber means self-isolating at home for up to 10 days, and red means quarantining at a hotel paid for by the travelers.
In the past few days, some government officials suggested double-jabbed passengers from amber-list countries could be exempt from quarantining.
We're also looking to see how we can replace the protections that are currently there with the restrictions with protections that come from the vaccine with respect to international travel as well. But it is more difficult freeing up international travel.
And difficult it will be when it comes to the willingness of other countries to let British tourists in. Germany has called on all EU countries to make British travelers quarantine on arrival to slow the spread of the Delta variant. All this as the UK recorded more than 16,000 new COVID cases Wednesday, the highest figure since early February, most of them caused by the Delta variant first discovered in India. There were also 19 deaths. The travel industry is yet to react to the government announcement, but with countries moving up and down the UK government's list, British travelers have to think again before they take a gamble. Saeed Puriza, London.
As anti-Westminster sentiment continues to rise, another part of Britain is entering the fight to break away from the UK. Cornwall, located on the southwest of the island, is witnessing the start of a new pro-independence advocacy group which aims to revive a lesser-known campaign for Cornish independence.
All Under One Banner's Cur Now is the latest branch in a wider organisation which already has roots in Scotland and Wales. In both countries, All Under One Banner has achieved significant success in opening up the debate on independence. Locals in Cornwall are hoping to achieve the same.
Many Cornish people, who are recognised as a Celtic minority, have various grievances with the English-centric London rule, including a lack of funding and a systematic destruction of an ancient culture.
That's a good way of explaining it. We're a long colonised place, possibly longer than the Welsh, who also probably feel that they've been colonised as well. But we've recovered that history, and that's one of our greatest successes. And the greatest challenge now is decolonising the history and explaining it to Anglo-Saxon ears.
In past campaigns, activists have been branded as nationalists who hate the English, a claim rejected by locals.
I've got no problem with the English or with any other nationality at all. What I have a problem with is the way that possibly we are represented through them, and the way sometimes we are talked down to and treated by them. But no, there's no problem at all. We have so many friends from all over the world down here.
For now, Cornish independence is a minority view, but lifelong campaigners believe things are changing.
I think we're already getting there in terms of greater autonomy, understanding the need for it. The next question is how to get it, and obviously there are political ways of getting it, but there's also a need for people to go out and campaign for it.
The idea of Scotland or Wales breaking away has sent shivers down Number 10. This latest development in Cornwall will surely only worsen Downing Street's fears. Robert Carter, London.
The US Justice Department committed a new flagrant violation of the freedom of the press and blocked several regional outlets' websites, including the Yemeni channel Al Masira and Iran's Press TV, claiming they are linked to what it calls Iranian disinformation efforts. Yemenis condemned this move, saying it proves that the US calls for freedom of speech are lies.
The seizure of some of the websites affiliated with the resistance front comes amid the media war. The Saudi-led coalition has been trying since the beginning of its war on Yemen to cover up its crimes committed against Yemenis and to mislead world public opinion.
Yemen's Ministry of Information said the U.S. government seizure of a few websites confirmed the strength of the media of the resistance and proved that these websites revealed the true face of the U.S., including its participation in the brutal Saudi war on Yemen.
We condemn the seizure of some websites affiliated with the resistance front. This move shows that these websites have been strong enough to influence the American public opinion by releasing the realities on the ground. It reveals the falsehood of American claims about democracy and freedom of speech. Certainly, there are solutions to this blocking, and the websites will be running again.
Ali Ashrai, the manager of Al Masira website, said this move revealed the weakness of the U.S., even though it owns thousands of media outlets.
This step reveals the great weakness that the United States is suffering from, even though it owns thousands of websites, satellite channels, newspapers, and radio stations. However, it was unable to withstand a few channels with limited capabilities which convey the truth as it is and express the opinion of the free people in this world.
Experts believe that this step is part of a media war of the U.S. government against the media outlets of the resistance. They said these attacks will persist and the resistance access should be ready for further violations.
Yemenis say the freedom of speech is a fundamental right for all free people of the world, and the United States has no right to deny individuals or communities this right. They believe that such attacks will promote the free media outlets to continue exposing the U.S. policies. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A number of Palestinian prisoners are going on with an open-ended hunger strike to protest their illegal imprisonment without charge or trial under Israel's so-called administrative detention. At least three prisoners insist to continue their strike despite their seriously deteriorating condition until Israel releases them. Among them is 28-year-old Ghadanfar Abu Atwan, who has started his hunger strike almost 50 days ago. After starting his strike, Israel's prison authorities placed him in isolation. Later, he was transferred to Kaplan Medical Center south of Tel Aviv because of his serious illness, and he's being held there under detention.
Of course, when all doors are shut down in the face of the prisoners to get rid of the administrative detention, they have few means to protest and they have to engage in the hunger strike battle, especially that many prisoners' terms are renewed for several times and this without charge or trial. When Radanfar started his protest, he was beaten and tortured by the Israeli jailers and he was held in solitary confinement.
Palestinians held a protest in solidarity with the prisoners outside the Red Cross Committee building in Ramallah. The oldest of those taking part is 59-year-old, a senior leader of the Hamas movement, Jamal al-Tawil, joined in protest over the detention of his daughter, journalist Bushat Tawil. He's demanding Israeli authorities to release him and his daughter. Israeli court had extended Bushra's previous administrative detention order last March. There is also Sheikh Khadr Adnan, prominent leader of the Jihad movement, whom is staging his fifth hunger strike. This is the 12th time he has been detained.
Today we are here not only to stand by the prisoners and support them. This is the least we can do against the administrative detention policy. Israel arrests people from all walks of life and different political spectrum. We are in real need to launch a national and worldwide campaign to force Israel to stop this policy that exposes the Israeli authorities and their illegal practices.
The Palestinian Prisoners Society said the Israeli authorities have lately increased the use of administrative detention against Palestinians. The committee said Israeli authorities issued 200 administrative detention orders since the beginning of May. The majority of the hunger-striking prisoners are those who are held arbitrarily under Israel's policy of administrative detention. That's why they put their lives on the line to demand not only their freedom, but an end to the administrative detention policy. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea visited South Korea for talks with both his South Korean and Japanese counterparts. Sung Kim then repeated Washington's desire for dialogue with Pyongyang.
Most importantly, we reaffirmed our two countries' shared commitment to pursuing the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula through diplomacy and dialogue. We took note of the recent statement out of Pyongyang regarding their preparation for dialogue. And we hope to receive a positive response to our proposal for a meeting soon.
U.S. President Joe Biden's new point man on North Korea, however, conditioned any negotiations on U.S.-led sanctions against North Korea remaining in place, which many see as a barrier to kickstarting broader denuclearization talks. Some activists suggest the tension provides the U.S. an excuse to deploy troops to the region and support American weapons producers.
The importance of the Korean Peninsula has increased as the U.S. military pressure and response to China has been strengthened. The traditional diplomatic and security establishment of the U.S. wants to maintain a certain level of conflict on the Korean Peninsula.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un last week told officials at a party meeting to be prepared for both dialogue and confrontation. Pyongyang later responded to Washington's offer of talks with ridicule, suggesting a wrong interpretation would lead to disappointment. The U.S. may be paying more attention to North Korea with the appointment of a special envoy in his five-day visit here to South Korea. The question is whether that will translate into greater flexibility from Washington in terms of offering Pyongyang some sanctions relief as North Korea deals with the COVID-19 pandemic and recent natural disasters. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In less than 2 months, Iran's president-elect Ebrahim Raisi will take over power, and speculations over the fate of the 2015 nuclear deal is now the talk of the town, while there are still major sticking points in the Vienna talks over the revival of the accord. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said the discussions are likely to reach a conclusion before the end of President Hassan Rouhani's term in mid-August.
There is a good possibility that we will reach an agreement before the end of our tenure.
In his weekly briefing, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the U.S. is slowing down the process.
Iran and the U.S. still have differences over some of the issues. What's ahead is for the U.S. to make a political decision and lift the sanctions.
Reports coming out of Vienna suggest that the excessive demands of the U.S. and European parties to the deal are to blame for the sluggish talks. The U.S. wants the destruction of Iran's new generation centrifuges in exchange for only a temporary suspension of some of the anti-Iran sanctions, a demand beyond Iran's commitments under the accord. In his first presser as president-elect, Raisi made it clear that the U.S. must lift all sanctions before Tehran returns to its full compliance to the atomic accord. He said he will not allow the talks to become erosive.
The Americans violated the JCPOA and the Europeans did not comply with their commitments. The U.S. was obliged to remove all sanctions under the JCPOA, but it has failed to do so. The Americans should return and fulfill their commitments. I tell the Europeans not to be impacted by the pressure and the foreign policy of the Americans and to fulfill their obligations under the JCPOA.
Officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action or the JCPOA, the nuclear deal has been in limbo for 3 years since the former U.S. administration discarded the accord in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. In a tit-for-tat, Tehran adopted a stepwise suspension of its own nuclear commitments. The last remedial step involved ramping up the purity level of enriched uranium to 60%, way above the 3.67% cap set by the deal. The Iranian Foreign Ministry hopes the Vienna talks will conclude before Rouhani's term is over. Observers say this scenario is the best for the U.S., and any foot-dragging means the talks will have to continue with the new Iranian administration, which maintains a tougher tone toward the U.S. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran's AB Home and several lawyers have filed a complaint against Mölnlycke Healthcare, a Swedish medical device company, over its refusal to sell medical products to Tehran under U.S. pressures. Mölnlycke Healthcare refused to sell Iranian AB patients medical care items they needed, including Mepilex dressings. Several children in Iran who suffered from epidermolysis bullosa lost their lives due to the lack of urgently needed medical equipment, and some others were hurt by severe physical injuries, including amputation. Many human rights groups have criticized the U.S. for cutting off banking ties with Iran through threatening the international banks with punitive fines by the U.S. Department of Treasury, which has resulted in cutting Iranian patients' access to necessary medical items.
Since May 2018, that the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, up to May 2019, a number of children suffering from EB died only because they did not have Mepilex dressings. I want to tell those who claim to be defenders of human rights what has been the crime of this 37-day-old baby who died of the disease only because we did not have Mepilex dressings as a result of the U.S. sanctions.
The move has deprived EB patients, also known as butterfly patients, of essential medical items, killed many of them, especially children, and inflicted serious physical injuries, such as amputation, to some of the patients. The complaint seeks to protect the victims of the open violation of human rights committed by the Swedish company and prevent similar criminal measures.
The Iranian Center for International Criminal Law, an NGO based in The Hague, has submitted a complaint to the Swedish National Contact Point stating that the Swedish company had breached the OECD guidelines by failing to undertake appropriate human rights due diligence, adversely affecting the human rights of EB patients in Iran and failing to remedy its impact. The lawsuit calls on Swedish National Contact Point to hold the company accountable and take action to compensate for the losses Iranian EB patients have suffered and to resume trading with Iran.
Nearly 30 Iranian EB patients, mostly children, have died since Mölnlycke stopped selling its dressings to Iran, saying that for EB survivors, the pain has increased by 70%. Iranian officials have repeatedly blasted the U.S. for imposing sanctions against the country, stressing that such inhumane sanctions have intensified the sufferings of kids with no access to special medicines for incurable diseases. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Four Saudis who participated in the 2018 killing of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi received paramilitary training in the United States the previous year under a contract approved by the U.S. State Department, according to documents and people familiar with the arrangement. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Mark Mazzetti, Julian Barnes, and Michael LaForgia. The piece is titled, Saudi Operatives Who Killed Khashoggi Received Paramilitary Training in United States. Four Saudi nationals who participated in the 2018 killing of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi received paramilitary training in the United States the previous year under a contract approved by the U.S. State Department, according to documents and people familiar with the arrangement. The instruction occurred as the secret unit responsible for Mr. Khashoggi's killing was beginning an extensive campaign of kidnapping, detention, and torture of Saudi citizens, ordered by Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, to crush dissent inside the kingdom. The training was provided by the Arkansas-based security company Tier 1 Group, which is owned by the private equity firm Cerberus Capital Management. The company says the training, including safe marksmanship and countering an attack, was defensive in nature and devised to better protect Saudi leaders. One person familiar with the training said it also included work in surveillance and close quarters battle. There is no evidence that the American officials who provided the training or Tier 1 group executives knew that the Saudis were involved in the crackdown inside Saudi Arabia, but the fact that the government approved high-level military training for operatives who went to carry out the grisly killing of a journalist shows how intensely intertwined the United States has become with an autocratic nation, even as its agents committed horrific human rights abuses. It also underscores the perils of military partnerships with repressive governments and demonstrates how little oversight exists for those forces after they return home. Such issues are likely to continue as American private military contractors increasingly look to foreign clients to shore up their business as the United States scales back overseas deployments after two decades of war. The U.S. State Department initially granted a license for the paramilitary training of the Saudi Royal Guard to Tier 1 Group, starting in 2014, during the Obama administration. The training continued during at least the first year of former President Donald J. Trump's term in office. Louis Bremer, a senior executive of Cerberus Capital Management, Tier 1 Group's parent company, confirmed his company's role in the training last year in written answers to questions from lawmakers as part of his nomination for a top Pentagon job during the Donald Trump administration. The administration does not appear to have sent the document to Congress before withdrawing Mr. Bremer's nomination. Lawmakers never received answers to their questions. In the document, which Louis Bremer provided to the New York Times, he said that four members of the Khashoggi kill team had received Tier 1 Group training in 2017, and two of them had participated in a previous iteration of the training, which went from October of 2014 until January of 2015. The training provided was unrelated to their subsequent heinous acts, Louis Bremer said in his responses. He said that a March 2019 review by Tier 1 Group uncovered no wrongdoing by the company and confirmed that the established curriculum training was unrelated to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Mr. Louis Bremer said that the State Department, in collaboration with other U.S. departments and agencies, is responsible for vetting the foreign forces trained on U.S. soil. All foreign personnel trained by the Tier 1 Group are cleared by the U.S. government for entry into the United States before commencement of their training. In a statement, Louis Bremer said that the training was protective in nature and that the company conducted no further training of Saudis after December of 2017. The Tier 1 Group management, the board, and I stand firmly with the U.S. government, the American people, and the international community in condemning the horrific murder of Jamal Khashoggi, he said. A 2019 column by David Ignatius of Washington Post first reported that members of the Khashoggi kill team had received training in the United States. David Ignatius wrote that the CIA had cautioned other government agencies that some special operations training may have been conducted by Tier 1 Group under a U.S. State Department license. The issue was central to Mr. Louis Bremer's contentious confirmation hearing and the written questions from senators asking him what role, if any, Tier 1 Group had in training Saudi nationals who had participated in the Jamal Khashoggi operation. A State Department spokesman declined to confirm whether it awarded licenses to Tier 1 Group for the Saudi training. This administration insists on responsible use of U.S. origin defense equipment and training by our allies and partners, and considers appropriate responses if violations occur, said the spokesman Ned Price. Saudi Arabia faces significant threats to its territory, and we are committed to working together to help Riyadh strengthen its defenses. Meanwhile, a spokesman for the Saudi embassy in Washington did not comment. former President Donald Trump weighed installing the head of Cerberus Capital Management, Steven Feinberg, in a top intelligence post last year, but the appointment was never made. While the Trump administration had appointed Mr. Feinberg to lead the president's intelligence advisory board in 2018, questions emerged about potential conflicts of interest. Cerberus Capital Management formerly owned the military contractor DynCorp, which among other things provides intelligence advice to the United States and other clients. It is unclear which members of the Khashoggi kill team participated in the Tier 1 group training. Seven members of the team belong to an elite unit charged with protecting the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, according to an American intelligence report about the assassination declassified in February. The role of operatives from the so-called Rapid Intervention Force in the Khashoggi killing helped bolster the American intelligence case that the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved the operation. Members of the Rapid Intervention Force would not have participated in the killing without his consent, according to the report. The group exists to defend the Saudi Crown Prince and answers only to him, the document said. Members of the team that killed Jamal Khashoggi were involved in at least a dozen operations starting in 2017, according to officials who have read declassified intelligence reports about the campaign. Mr. Khashoggi, a columnist for the Washington Post, was killed inside the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul in October of 2018. His body was dismembered using a bone saw. The assassination brought widespread condemnation of the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who tried to deny any knowledge of the operation. Eight defendants were sentenced to up to 2 decades in prison last year, but human rights advocates criticized the punishments as aimed at lower-level agents while sparing their leaders. The CIA concluded that the Saudi Crown Prince directed the operation, but Donald Trump said the evidence was inconclusive and that America's diplomatic and economic relationship with Saudi Arabia took priority. After President Joe Biden took office and debated the issue with his advisors before the release of the declassified intelligence report, his administration announced sanctions on Saudi citizens involved in the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, including members of the elite unit who protect the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. But President Joe Biden chose not to directly punish the Saudi Crown Prince. The earlier iteration of the training, which took place during the Obama administration, occurred before Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman consolidated his power in the kingdom. His predecessor as Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Nayef, was a close ally of the United States and in particular of John O. Brennan, who served as CIA Director General under President Barack Obama. Prince Mohammed bin Nayef was the Saudi counterterrorism chief and collaborated closely with the Obama administration officials. In 2017, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman pushed Prince Mohammed bin Nayef from power and executed a broader campaign to wrest power from his rivals, including a notorious episode of imprisoning Saudi royals and businessmen at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh. The Trump administration considered him a valuable partner in the Middle East, and Prince Mohammed bin Salman developed a close relationship with Jared Kushner, the former president's son-in-law who served as a senior advisor to Donald Trump. Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the son of King Salman, is the next in line to the Saudi throne. Prince Mohammed bin Nayef remains under house arrest in Saudi Arabia. The Tier 1 group website lists numerous American special operations and intelligence units as clients, along with specialty units that do not require recognition. It said it also trains OGA special operator teams one pseudonym for CIA paramilitary units, as well as international allied forces. Under federal rules that restrict foreign sales of American arms and military expertise, Tier 1 Group was required to apply for licenses to train the foreign operatives. Those license applications were examined by State Department officials who were processing tens of thousands of licenses per year, and they were approved. The approval would have allowed members of the Saudi Royal Guard to enter the United States on visas processed by the American Embassy in Riyadh. The path is similar to the one followed by Second Lieutenant Mohammad al-Shamrani, a Royal Saudi Air Force officer who opened fire in 2019 at a naval air station in Pensacola, Florida, where he was receiving military flight training. That attack killed at least three people and wounded eight others.
Africa Today.
Despite an estimated 2,000 languages being spoken across Africa, for many to succeed in the continent, they have no option but to learn English or French, the languages of the countries which colonize most of Africa. Now, experts are warning that this trend might lead to the extinction of indigenous languages. Renowned African writer Ngugi Wa Thiong'o says abandoning one's indigenous language is tantamount to enslavement. Let's take a listen.
There's a difference between adding another language to what you already have, which I call empowerment, and what I call the other, where you add many languages. You remove your own language completely, and then you acquire other languages, which I call enslavement. Yeah.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to this edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on the dangers that African languages are facing amid rapid globalization, which has seen the dominance of English and French. Our experts will provide an incisive analysis and present possible solutions to this challenge facing African nations, which are fighting to preserve their identity. It will be great hearing from you, so keep in touch through our social media handle.
English, French imperil African languages. Africa has 55 countries that use a variety of languages, including some that are endangered due to several factors, especially the influence of Western culture. Every African language is a repository of history, culture, and values. So when a language dies, so too does history, culture, values, and a sense of identity. African language experts are waking up to the reality that a lack of school reading material in local languages is increasingly sounding the death knell for mother tongues.
With bilingual education, children are more active because they master the language. They are not afraid to speak to the teacher. They communicate better in a local language, a language they know well.
Experts and activists across Africa are now trying to restore the link between the people and their mother tongues. Now, for more analysis on this subject, we contacted Professor Kimani Njogu. He's a Kenyan linguist and a publisher who is also a member of the Kiswahili Cross-Border Language Commission at the African Academy of Languages, an organ of the African Union. Thank you very much, Professor.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
We also have Mr. Africa Kiiza, a development anthropologist based in Kampala, Uganda. Thank you also for joining us today.
Most welcome. Thank you for having me.
Now, Professor Kimani Njogu, first tell us, why is it important to maintain indigenous languages in Africa?
Well, you see, languages are carriers of culture. They are also carriers of knowledge, and they are carriers of histories. And this is not particular to African languages or indigenous languages. This refers to virtually all languages of the world. Therefore, when we preserve and develop indigenous African languages, we are, in a sense, appreciating and recognizing their place as carriers of African history or the histories of the African people and their experiences, as well as their knowledge systems and their philosophies and their values and so forth and so on. So the development and the promotion of African languages is part of a whole system of appreciating knowledge production from the African continent.
Thank you for that, Professor Kimani Njogu.
Love for European languages in Africa comes from the colonial mentality that foreign languages are better than their local languages and are a guarantee for the future. Once young people go to higher education, they abandon their mother tongues, thinking they are archaic, and prefer to speak foreign languages such as French or English.
Now, Mr. Kiza, how has over-reliance on European languages while abandoning local languages affected development in Africa?
We have lost on this freedom of determining our own development path as Africa because the current narrative and agenda of development is informed by the culture and language of the West. So it is important if we are to develop as Africa from our own pace, and often as Africa we have been saying we wish to have Africa solutions to African problems. We cannot have this narrative. We cannot achieve this narrative of having African solutions to African problems when we keep relying on a language which is not ours.
Now, globalization and social media are also driving Africans away from their mother tongues. Many people are also no longer feeling proud to speak their mother tongues, as English and French and other European languages have replaced local languages in homes and schools in many parts of Africa. Our Zimbabwean language expert here speaks on the importance of the preservation of indigenous languages. Let's listen.
It's good to share information, exchange ideas, but at the end of the day, who are we? We need to know our identity. We need to actually build on what we know, build on what makes us, Zimbabweans.
Professor Kimani Njogu, now how serious is the threat faced by African languages from European languages, especially English and French?
They are in danger, really, of this suppression and domination by European languages, notwithstanding the fact that they are the ones, that is African languages, they are the ones that are spoken by over 70% or 80% of Africans across the continent. Therefore, the danger here is that the continued domination of indigenous languages or African languages by European languages undermines African histories, African philosophies, and the contribution of the continent to knowledge, global knowledge. And therefore, it's really a very serious issue here.
It's quite clear that European colonial languages have continued to dominate in education, commerce, the media, and interaction between African countries. While international languages are crucial for communication and academic transfer and engagement, the use of indigenous languages ensures that local populations are integrated in the development agenda. Is the use of English and French in most development documents in Africa discriminatory to those who do not understand or actually do not want to use these languages?
African countries are actually, currently we are negotiating the African Continental Free Trade Area, an agreement that is going to unite to bring about an open market, a common market of free movement of goods and services within Africa. But there is actually fighting among us, the Francophone-speaking Africa, the French-speaking Africa, and the English-speaking Africa countries. because of the fact that which language takes precedence.
Local languages in Africa, just like in many parts of the world, are the basis for cultural identity and local development. African languages that survived the colonial era are now facing the danger of extinction amid an onslaught by European languages. During a visit to Burkina Faso in 2018, French President Emmanuel Macron unveiled his strategy to promote his native language, aiming to make it the first language in Africa.
Now let's go back to Professor Kimani Njogu. Do you think the gradual disregard of indigenous languages in Africa is a deliberate move by imperial powers to wipe out the identity of African people?
Well, let me say this, that the colonial project was always a project of domination and suppression of competing ideas. And therefore, under colonialism, the French deliberately suppressed African languages in their colonies, and the British did the same with regard to African languages, and the Portuguese did the same. Therefore, one could say that the colonial project was a project to deny the African people their identity and the base from which they could recollect their history. And even in situations where these languages were supported, they were not deliberately developed. And this has continued through the post-colonial period.
Now, speaking in 2019 during the International Day of the World's Indigenous Peoples, UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed spoke on the need to preserve, revitalize, and promote indigenous languages.
Almost half the world's estimated 6,700 languages are in danger of disappearing. Many of those belong to indigenous people. With every language that disappears, a world loses a wealth of traditional knowledge and cultural heritage. Education will have a pivotal role to play in ensuring that indigenous people can enjoy and preserve their culture and identity. Intercultural and multilingual education will be necessary to prevent the irreparable loss.
Now, Ms. Akiza, what are some of the urgent measures that need to be taken to ensure that future generations in Africa continue using local languages?
Yes, that's an interesting question. The first one and most critical is human capacity, human capital development. We need to invest in building the capacity of our human resource, of our development policymakers, of our negotiators, especially the young ones, of the development commentators, in ensuring that they speak our own languages, in investing resources in our own universities of higher learning, our own research institutions, to teach in African languages, to teach development from an African perspective and reality is another issue which I think is critical if African countries are to nurture and to bring back the African languages with among the young generations.
Thank you very much, Mr. Africa Kiza, for your insight today. Now we shall take a short break, so don't go away.
English-French imperil African languages.
In 2019, linguistic history was made after students at the University of Cape Town in South Africa graduated from an indigenous language course with roots that date back more than 200,000 years. The Khoisan are known to be one of the earliest inhabitants of Southern Africa, but their language was largely lost during the colonial period. A student who studied the language in university speaks on her accomplishment.
The course itself was an amazing journey to go on to learn this language that was used by my ancestors, by everyone's ancestors. Definitely made a change in my life, and it makes a change in everyone's life, just even to know a few words out of it.
Now, Professor Kimani Njogu, what sort of intervention is needed to uplift the indigenous languages in Africa?
Now, I think the first place for immediate intervention is to look at the educational system and to ask the question, how can we build a continuity, a continuum between what the child experiences within the community in terms of language and what the child experiences within the educational system? How can we build a continuity in the two experiences?
Renowned African novelist from Kenya, Professor Ngugi wa Thiong'o, didn't deliver his acceptance speech in English when last year he was honored as the 31st recipient of the Catalonia International Prize for his daring and distinguished literary work and defense of African languages. He has been writing in his native Kikuyu language since the 80s after abandoning English. Ngugi wrote a book titled Decolonizing the Mind, The Politics of Language in African Literature. He explains here on how he made the revolutionary decision to write in his mother tongue.
That I would no longer write my fiction or poetry in English anymore. I was going to write in an African language, and I was going to write in the only language then I knew quite well, which was Kikuyu. I had to do this. I had to find a way of connecting myself to myself, you know, and I had to go against that whole colonial assumption, you know, that people can only know themselves via England, in this case, or via European languages, or via Europe.
In July 2004, Kiswahili was declared the official language of the 55-member African Union, with the then-chairperson Joachim Chissano delivering his entire speech during the AU summit in the language. Now, Professor Kimani Njogu, you earlier talked there about the Swahili or Kiswahili language. As we know, the African Union has adopted Swahili language as one of its official languages. Do you think this language can be used as the lingua franca in Africa?
Absolutely. I think that, first of all, we must commend the African Union for taking the position that Swahili or Kiswahili be adopted as one of its official languages and therefore used at the African Union meetings, at the Pan-African Parliament, and other, fora across the continent. That action is very significant because it makes Kiswahili the only African language that plays that role at the African Union level. Now, there is no doubt in my mind that there is immense hope in the utility of Kiswahili as the lingua franca of the continent, or even just and without in fact suggesting that Kiswahili will undermine, other languages. It will sit alongside other African languages, but it will play a very important role in encouraging inter-ethnic communication and international communication across the continent.
Thank you very much, Professor Kimani Njogu, for that insight.
Last year in South Africa, Swahili was approved as an optional language for the country's schools. South Africa was the first Southern African country to offer Swahili as an optional subject in schools, raising hopes for the growth of this language all across Africa. A South African teacher here elaborates on the importance of the adoption of Swahili language in her country.
We do welcome the introduction of Swahili because we believe that it is going to promote unity and will promote intercontinental trade and exchanges within the continent.
More African countries are starting to teach Swahili language. What is motivating these countries to teach this East African language?
Its acceptability level is very, very high because, unlike many other languages, it's not ethnically bound in a strong way. So there is no strong ethnic identity associated with the Swahili language. And therefore, its acceptability is higher than, say, any of the other languages that we have, so that a Wolof speaker would be able to speak and learn Swahili without feeling that they are learning a very, very foreign language. In any case, it is situated on the continent. Its rhythm and spirit is the spirit and rhythm of the continent of Africa.
A glance at leading industrial countries across the world clearly shows that all school-going kids in these countries receive their elementary instruction in their first language. This includes countries in North America, Europe, and also Japan, China, South Korea, and Russia.
Now, a Nigerian teacher who has been teaching mathematics in a local language explains here on the advantages of using indigenous languages in a class.
One of the major popular research was done in the Yoruba land, where we had some students who were, for example, who were taught a subject using Yoruba language. So they had two groups of students. One group was taught a particular subject using Yoruba language, while another group was taught English language, and then taught the subject in English. When the result was looked at the end of the day, the highest success rate was recorded from the students who were taught using the Yoruba language. And that's because we can never rule out the power the mother tongue has with regard to learning.
While some indigenous languages in Africa are threatened with extinction, but as we have seen, the tide is turning as more and more young people are learning the languages. Yet to remain relevant, these indigenous languages need to embrace technology.
Now finally, my last question to you, Professor Kimani Njogu. Now what needs to be done to make indigenous African languages appear cool and attractive to the tech-savvy generation?
And African languages are adaptive to really the changing environment. They are never static. They are responsive to the changes that we experience every day. So, for example, with the entry of mobile phones, African languages are at play in that technology, and they are utilized pretty well in really articulating the technologies. The other area of work really is to link the techies with language workers. Those of us who work with language every day ought to be able to work closely with innovators, with technologists, to be able to come up with terms that best serve, you know, the needs of the techies.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Kimani Njogu, a member of the Kiswahili Cross-Border Language Commission at the African Academy of